Well, I want to welcome everybody and have a good holiday, everybody. Yeah, good. We discovered up north in Ormond Beach that down jackets are good things to own still up there. It was, pardon? Yeah, and here as well. Yeah. So you know you've been in Florida for a few years when it gets into the upper 40s and you're looking for down. So your blood's thinned out pretty well. So it used not to be the case. Well, I'm really looking forward to moving forward in our study. Today we are beginning, we're at day 229, and we're starting with the Sermon on the Mount. So if you don't have a book with you, you can turn to the fifth chapter of Matthew. But what, and we're not going to rush through this, okay? We're going to take our time in the Sermon on the Mount because it is so important. I want to start, though, at day 232, all right? I want to start at the end and then work back. To talk a little bit about the Sermon on the Mount. How many of you have read the Sermon on the Mount before? How many of you have gone, what's this about? What is this? There are so many different ways of interpreting the Sermon on the Mount. One of the privileges that I had when we lived in Southern California was getting to know Dallas Willard. And Dallas's writing and teaching on the Sermon on the Mount was so important. But what I want to start with this morning is I'd like everybody who knows how to read to raise your hand. Everybody who can read, okay? If you can read, raise your hand. Now, how many of you don't really know how to read? There is a difference in reading and knowing how to read. If you just read through the Sermon on the Mount and say, I've read it, I want to say, you ain't even scratched the surface yet, all right? Years ago, when I was, before I'd ever been to seminary, I came across a wonderful book written by Mortimer J. Adler, who taught education at Columbia University. And Betsy, did you see the chapters in the announcement this morning?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Thank you. You're welcome very much. So she was getting after me a few weeks ago saying the chapters are not in there. They are this week now. Anyhow, Mortimer Adler wrote a book called How to Read a Book. All right? And to read, to really read for understanding, is reading one time enough? No. What happens when you read the first time? You're not really grasping what he's saying, so you kind of get a feel for it. Matthew 5, 6, and 7, three chapters are where you find the Sermon on the Mount. So if you want to read for understanding, the second time you go through, what do you think it's important to do as you're reading if you really want to read well? What do you think you should do? Make some notes. Good. Anybody else? Slow down, Chuck. Thank you. That's the right answer. Slow down. How about this? Ask questions.
Okay.
Ask a lot of questions about what's going on. And if you don't ask the questions, what happens when you read it through your own filters. Okay? And when you read it through your own filters, oftentimes it doesn't mean that you may not understand some of it, but guess whose stuff gets mixed up with what you're reading? Yours does, okay? And so you've got to go through that second time. And Adler says then you read a third time and you really work your way through, as the writer of the book of Proverbs, tasting what's deeply there. So that's what we're going to take our time through these weeks getting into the Sermon on the Mount because they're so important. Well, let's begin with our prayer that we pray every week as we say, Lord, help us see you more clearly in order that we can love you more dearly and follow you more nearly day by day. Amen. All right, Yancey, I love what he writes on day 232. If you don't have your book, this is not in the scriptures. What does he say? What was the impact that the Sermon on the Mount made on him as a teenager?
Yep.
What's the word that he uses? It haunted him as an adolescent. He said, I'd read a book like Charles Sheldon's In His Steps, solemnly vow to act as Jesus would act, turn to Matthew 5 through 7 for guidance, what to make of such advice. Should I offer myself to be pummeled by the motorcycle riding hoods in school? What's the answer to the question? Well, should you lend to anybody who asks of you without expecting anything back? Maybe, maybe not. Should I tear my tongue out after speaking a harsh word to my brother? Should I gouge my right eye out if it causes me to sin? If you go around looking for people without a right eye, okay, you're probably talking to somebody who didn't learn how to read the Sermon on the Mount, okay? So he goes, he says, to begin with, the Beatitudes, are they true? And what's his answer to the question? Not only are they true, they are important truths. And he said, I fail to understand Jesus' teaching if I don't understand the Sermon on the Mount. He said, dangled promises. He said, they are not merely Jesus' hollow words of consolation to the unfortunates. Okay? For convicts in the Soviet gulag, have any of you ever read Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich? Have you not? Who's not? Raise your hands if you haven't. Go read it. Okay? It is absolute. Read the Russians. But Denisovich, it's absolutely fascinating because here he is one day in the life of a prisoner in the Soviet gulag, and he finds a little piece of hacksaw and a crust of bread, and he squirrels it away. And it's the beginning of his wrestling with his journey coming to faith. And when he became the darling of the left until he was invited to give the commencement speech at Harvard. And all of a sudden, the Harvard community realized that this guy had become a hardcore follower of Jesus, and he ceased to be the darling of the intellectual elites following that speech. Solzhenitsyn is hugely important. He says, for the convicts in the Soviet gulag, and for slaves in America and Christians in Roman cages awaiting their turn with wild beasts, the promise of reward, which Jesus speaks to, has become a source of hope. It keeps you, what's the next word? Alive. It allows you to believe in a just God, after all. Then he talks about the great reversal. And he said, as we get into the Beatitudes, you'll see an incredible reversal. They express quite plainly that God views the world through a different set of lenses than yours or mine. And that's why it's important to get the right lenses. And psychological reality, he said, they reveal what brings us success in the kingdom of heaven, and that what brings us success there also benefits us most in this life, here and now. Interesting proposition, is it not? Is that true? Something to think about, something to wrestle with. I would rather spend time among the servants of this world than among the stars. Jane and I were with Phil in Orlando few years ago. I've told you we all worked together at Youth for Christ back in the late 60s. And so when we were talking to him, we said, Phil, we would love to have you come to Ocean Reef. And he said, let me get back to you on that. A few weeks later, he called me back and he said, Bob, as much as I would love to come to Ocean Reef, he said, the people who work with me, they're sending me to more important places. You know where they were sending him? To the rough parts of the world. So when he says, I would rather spend time among the servants, He's talking about those people who are spiritual leaders in some of the hardest places of the world. He said, that's where I spend my time. That's where my people send me. So that's what's behind that statement in his life. He says, then he talks about the uncompromising harshness. Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. I would like everyone who has achieved that to please stand. I'm going to sit down. Okay. Really? I mean, is that what he's talking about here? Jesus said the statements tucked almost casually between the command to love your enemies and give away money. Be perfect like God. So we're going to pass the offering plate again, and I just want you to, whatever you got at the bottom of your P&L, okay, just put it in the plate, and all right, and then go out. Is that what it means? No, it's not. Got to read carefully. Then he talks about Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. I had a group of guys in Los Angeles that we would meet for a book club once a month. We gave ourselves the most pretentious name we could come up with, the Gentleman's Literary Society. All right? Is that full of it or what? Okay, we met an attorney, Dan, and we were on a search committee together, and I was reading Anna Karenina. And I was just raving about the Russian writers that I'd never read before. I'd read Tolstoy's Crime, I'd read Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and I would literally go to sleep at night with sweat breaking out from reading about Raskolnikov. Okay, the thing you love about Dostoevsky, who are the heroes? Who are the heroines? Are they the good people? No, they are the prostitute who was Raskolnikov's friend. She is the true believer because Dostoevsky recognizes our need of grace. Dostoevsky spent, I think I'm right about this, he spent 10 years in a Russian gulag pouring through the New Testament. So the Russians, to me, when I read Anna Karenina, I can still see some of those scenes, and you can smell the hay being cut by the guys out in the meadow there. So these people have shaped Tolstoy. He started to think, I can achieve at this level. Guess what? He became what Larry was talking about this morning. He became an arrogant spiritual prig that nobody could put up with. And then you have Dostoevsky, who brings grace. Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. None of us achieve that. What does that point to our need of? Grace. And apart from grace, we're all S-O-L. Excuse me for not saying it out loud, but that's just the truth of what it is. So now, are you ready to get into the Beatitudes? All right. With that introduction from Yancey and yours truly. Page 229, Matthew 5. Now, what's the very first thing that Matthew writes? What's the first thing you read there?
When Jesus saw the crowds.
When he saw the crowds. Who were the crowds? Where did they come from? Why did they come? What drew them to come? If you're like many of us, we've been to the Mount of Beatitudes there in Israel. You've been to that lovely Catholic church that's there and that hospitality house. But over the fence to the right is the bowl, probably where Jesus talked. So these crowds came from all over Galilee. They came from up in what would be Lebanon today. They came from the Decapolis. They came up from Judea, where Jerusalem is. He saw the crowds. What did he do? Where did he go? Went up on a mountainside. Okay, now, who is Matthew written to? Written to a Jewish community. So, know any other Jewish leader that ever went up on a mountainside? Huh? Who is it, Cheryl? No, not Jesus. That's the wrong answer this time, and it's not a squirrel either. Who's the other person who went up on a mountainside? Important Jewish figure. Who? Moses. Oh, what did he do when he went up there? Who did he hang out with? He hung out with God for a while, didn't he? All right. And when he came down from the mountain, what did he bring with him? Besides a glowing face, what did he bring down? The commandments. What do we call the commandments? The law. Okay. So when Jesus goes up on a mountainside, if I'm a Jewish reader, who might I think he is becoming like? Becoming like Moses. And what did he have the people do? They came to it. He sat down, and what did he begin to do? He began to teach them. So do you think as we come to the Sermon on the Mount, this is maybe Jesus being the second Moses, and he is going to tell people about how we have a relationship with God, what it looks like? And Moses gave the commandments. What Jesus is going to do in the Sermon on the Mount, he is going to go through the commandments, but he is going to help people understand them the way who intended. And why? How can Jesus do that? He's God. Oh, okay. All right. Thank you very much. So now we start with a word that's going to recur repeatedly. What's that word? Blessed. The word in Hebrew is ashrei. And it means the joy of God's presence, the blessing of God. And Phil kind of wrestles with two meanings at the end of this chapter. Who is blessed first?
The poor in spirit.
The poor in spirit. What does it mean to be poor in spirit? What's that, Betsy? Not have faith. That's a good shot, but it's a great answer. Let's keep working at it. Somebody else.
See the glass half empty instead of half full.
Seeing the glass half empty instead of half full. So he's looking at circumstances. Okay, but he's talking about poor where? So who's this applied to? Oh, to people. Okay, blessed are people who are what? Poor in spirit. What do you think it means to be poor in spirit? Well, I'd like every spiritual giant in the room to please stand. Every spiritual giant in the room, would you please stand and take your place? Okay, Jim, you and Rick. Okay, stand up back here, right? All right, have you ever met people who think they're spiritual giants? Yes, we have. We've all met one or two, right? Okay. Poor in spirit means recognizing your spiritual poverty. It means recognizing your spiritual poverty, that I am not the spiritual giant, that I am a person who has need of God. And now, who in Jesus' audience was not poor in spirit? Who in Jesus' audience in the day was not poor in spirit? Pharisees. Oh, we're good. We're spiritual giants. And how did the crowds think of, if they let the Pharisees explain to them who they were, how would the Pharisees make the crowds who came to hear Jesus feel? Little. Belittled, you're nothing. And so who is Jesus, this great reversal? What's the great reversal that's going on here? You got a bunch of Pharisees and Sadducees and scribes and teachers of the law hanging out in the crowd. Did they think they were blessed to be poor in spirit? They thought, no, we're blessed to be who we are. And what's Jesus telling the crowd? The people who are really blessed by God are not these guys hanging out around the edge who think they've got it all together. They're the people who recognize their what? Their need of God. So, wow, you got my attention now. if I'm some guy from the Decapolis that I don't think God wants anything to do with, you mean somebody like me can be blessed of God? Yeah. Blessed are those who what?
Mourn.
Wait, what's the promise to the people who are poor in spirit? Theirs is the what? Kingdom of heaven. Now that is a loaded term, is it not? We've talked about that before. Who thought they were in the kingdom? All these religious leaders. Who gets into the kingdom? People who recognize their need. That's who gets in. Now, blessed are those who mourn. How many of you have grieved a loss at some time in your life? We all have, right? Everybody has. You live long enough, you will. Guaranteed. Okay, what does it mean to mourn? When you lose a loved one, what is it? When you mourn, what does it mean? Sad. Yep. Yeah. What, Rick? Loss. Feel a great loss. Okay. Anybody else?
Lonely.
Pardon?
Lonely.
Okay. Yeah. Heartbroken. Yeah. Disappointed. All right. Yeah. Any of you lost a child? My brother died at 38. I watched what my folks went through with that, the mourning. Now, is he talking about the loss of a loved one here?
You can mourn many things.
Loss
of the synagogue.
Yep. Let's put it in the context now of what he's teaching. You're poor in spirit. What are you mourning, perhaps?
The loss of that spirit.
Your spiritual condition. Now, blessed are people who mourn their spiritual condition, because what's the promise of Jesus? They're going to be what? They're going to be... Now, does God comfort us in our little literal mourning? What's the answer to the question? Oh, absolutely. He does. Incredible comfort. But here, Jesus is talking to the crowds. He's not talking about losing a loved one. He's talking about the spiritual condition, the poor in spirit. Blessed are people who mourn their spiritual condition. How many of you, like me, mourn your spiritual condition at times? When Larry was preaching this morning, there was one verse that just hit me like a ton of bricks. One line out of those texts that he gave this morning that just somehow resonated right here. People who recognize their spiritual condition, what does God promise to do for them? To give them real comfort, to comfort us in that, because people who mourn their spiritual condition, all of a sudden I've got room for God to move in my life. If I think my spiritual condition's great, I don't need a thing, do I? No, I've got it all, right? No, I don't. Blessed are the what? The meek. Aren't you glad that Ocean Reef is such a gathering of meek people? I've told you, I'm pretty convinced that on the membership application somewhere, there's a sign that says Indian or chief. And if you check Indian, you don't get in. This is a gathering of chiefs unlike any other place I've ever been before in my life. Do you know what meekness is? It's submitted strength. It's submitted strength. It's not weakness. I've told this story before, but it's the only good illustration I have, Jane. So before you tell me you've told this before, I'll tell you now that I know I've told it before. And it was our daughter when she was about 4 with our buddy who owned he was a calf roper. And he had this horse. I mean, I stood behind it behind the pen where he goes out. And when that horse took off, I'm here to tell you, as Carole King wrote, you feel the earth move under your feet. And then Jim said, put your daughter up on that horse. I said, are you out of your mind? He said, no, no, no. This horse knows that it's a little girl up on there. He'll be as tame as a circus pony. And that is a picture of meekness. I submit my strength to whom? To God. To be used to serve Him and His purposes. Blessed are the meek, because what will they inherit?
The earth.
They're the ones who are going to inherit the earth. Think about that one. Blessed are those who, what comes next? Any of you ever really been, has anybody in this room been hungry ever? You've been really hungry? You're a teenager. Of course you have. You think you're dying of hunger all the time, right? When our daughter, how old are you now?
16.
When our daughter was 16, she was on the swim team in high school, okay? She would bring all of these girls from the swim team. They would walk in our front door, and they would all walk in and go, "Hi, Dad, hi, Dad, hi, Dad, hi, Dad, hi, Dad, hi." And when they left, it looked like our every food, you know, all was left in the house were bones. There was nothing left to eat after they left. Hunger, what is hunger? It's a yearning. It's a need that we have. Anybody been thirsty?
Yeah.
First time I took Jane backpacking, the topo map indicated streams all along the way. Guess what? They were all dry. As we got about 10 miles in, guess what we were? We were thirsty. Nothing will satisfy like water. What is it that we are to hunger for?
Righteousness.
Righteousness. What does it mean to be righteous?
Have a oneness with God.
Oneness with God, that's a great answer. Righteousness means this, to be rightly related to things. So it is this great hunger and desire to live in right relationship to things. The first important relationship is our relationship with whom? God. With God. Until that one's right, none of the others are going to be right. And then it's, okay, Lord, how do I live righteously in my marriage? I would like every perfect husband to stand, please. Okay? I'm sitting. All right? I'd like every perfect wife to stand. You know, the old joke about the husband and her wife go to marriage counseling, and the therapist says something to him about the perfect husband. And the husband says to the therapist, "Well, the only perfect husband was my wife's first husband." Okay. Yeah. Yeah. He was perfect. Now I'm living with what's his name here now. So it's being rightly related. It is a desire to honor God by being rightly related to everything in my life. And the Beatitudes are going to cover all that. Being rightly related to my money. Being rightly related to how I use the influence I've been given in my life. Rightly related to my kids. We just had 5 of our grandkids with us for better part of 2.5 weeks. And I got to tell you, the job our kids are doing is so much better than we were doing. And I agree with Larry and Ruthie. It's so wonderful to have grandkids come because then you can kick them out and send them back. Off they go. But our 16-year-old, 14-year-old grandson from Sweden, this kid, I got to tell you, he's just the most incredible kid and the relationship that we're privileged to have. I taught my 8-year-old granddaughter how to cast and catch a bass in the pond behind our house. She caught her first fish. I got to tell you, she's grinning from ear. So how to be rightly related to our grand? If you've got as many as Gus does, I don't know how you do it. You know, I mean, when we've got families like that, how do I be rightly related to my friends? How do I be rightly related to my work responsibilities, to the science that I'm doing, to the finance that I'm doing, to whatever it is you do? God, teach me how to be rightly related to all of those arenas of my life so that who is honored? Who's honored? So that God is. When I talk about God and I'm not acting like I'm rightly related, does that diminish the impact of my words? You bet it does. If drivers would just listen to me when I'm in the car, the world would be such a better place. And my wife just laughs her butt off at me saying, if only they could hear what you're saying to them. And I'm very unrighteous behind the wheel when somebody is tailgating, all right? What's the promise to people who long to be filled with righteousness? What is it? What's the promise? We'll be what? We'll be filled. Let me tell you something. I've been, 1966 is when my faith, when God began my faith journey. I've got to tell you that the fulfillment of this faith journey is a fulfillment I could never have imagined anything greater than. And I could never imagine that God would make it happen the way He has made it happen. That is the joy of the journey. That's the joy of the journey. Okay, blessed are the what?
Merciful.
Okay, the crowds. Who showed them great mercy? Who didn't show them great mercy? What does mercy mean, first of all? Okay, all right. Here's what mercy means. Grace is getting what you don't deserve. Okay? Mercy is getting less than you deserve. Okay? And here's how my mentor used to explain it when his kid was 8. Act up. This is in the day when corporal punishment was still standard, which it should be today, appropriately applied. When the board of education is applied to the seat of learning, which our kids will tell you about, and they seem to be okay with all of this. So his son would do something, and he'd say, "All right, come up to your room. It's going to be 10 whacks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Dad, that's just 5. That's right. That's mercy. You're getting less than you deserve." Then he'd say to him, "Now, want to go get some ice cream?" "Yeah, that's grace. That's getting what you don't deserve." All right, does that help? Grace, getting what you don't deserve. Mercy, less than you deserve. If I am one who has been on the receiving end of being unmerciful, am I going to struggle with this? If these very righteous people have been putting me down and treating me like this, and now Jesus comes along and says, "Blessed are the what? The merciful." My first thing is I'm going to say, "Yeah, but what about them?" Right? Is there a "what about them" clause in this? No. Okay, blessed are the merciful, because what will people who act with mercy receive? Mercy. How many of you would like mercy? How many of us would like to get less than we deserve? We all would, right? So what does it mean in being righteous in every area of our life? It means giving, somehow learning to be merciful. Is it easy to be merciful? Sometimes, other times, not so much at all. So Jesus now, what is He trying to do with this crowd of people? He's first of all telling them how important they are. He wants them to know how important, well, let me get to that in just a minute. We'll come to that in the next section. I'm getting way ahead of myself. All right. Now, blessed are the what? For they will what? Anybody want to see God? What do you have to be? Okay, now put this in a Jewish context. Tell me how this becomes music to the ears of Jesus' hearers. What? Oh, how? Why would the Pharisees think they're pure? They kept all the rules. So if you want to be pure, you do what? Keep the rules. That's why none of you are pure. That's what they were thinking about the crowd. That's why none of you are pure. Okay? Not outwardly pure, but pure where? Heart. Our daughter, when she visiting with a friend this morning who graduated from Wheaton, our daughter, when she finished her junior year, of college. She'd been 3 years at UC Santa Cruz. You know anything about Santa Cruz? Okay, their team mascot are banana slugs. Okay, go slugs. I mean, that was the cheer. The last year, she, by assignment, was living in the gay and lesbian dorms. She played water polo all 3 years there. She's a tough girl, tough athlete. Then she said, I want to go to Bible school. So we, because she was so far into her junior year when she finished that, into her senior year. So we said, okay, we have friends who run a Bible school in Estes Park, and we'll send you there for a year. And so Bonnie Thomas, whose dad was Cliff Barrows, Bonnie convinced Karis that she should go to Wheaton. And so she said, do you think I can get in? Well, she got right in. And so Jane and I fly to Chicago. We're meeting with her. She comes to lunch and she is in tears. I can't stay at the school. Why, honey? Why? What's wrong? They have so many rules. Dad, I can't drink wine. Dad, I can't dance. Dad, I can't do any of these things. So can you imagine crazier than going from Santa Cruz to Wheaton College? All right? You know what I told her? I said, honey, you can keep the rules, but the rules don't define who you are. The rules don't define who you are. And that girl spent 3 great years at Wheaton. Friend, it is not, friends, so many people think I've got to get my life cleaned up before I can come to God. You know, I've somehow got to be something that I'm not now. Get over that. The people who come are the people who know that they're not pure in heart, but long to see God do something in here that is a miracle that He works on the inside. Because the promise, not to the rule keepers, but to the honest people who really long to know God, is that what? What will they see? They'll come to understand who God is, not see literally. But how many of you are finding this good news? I don't know about you. I love the Beatitudes for what they are. Blessed are the peacemakers. The zealots. Remember who the zealots were? Were they peacemakers? No, they were the terrorists. They would have been Antifa. Okay, they would have been Hamas. All right. So blessed are people who want to bring shalom to the world, shalom to their relationships. Now, I love what Romans, is it easy being a peacemaker with everybody? No, it is not. I love what Romans says, insofar as it depends on you, be at peace with all people. But you can't make everybody else, all right? You just got to deal with yourself, right? Blessed are the peacemakers, because what will they be called? Sons and daughters of God. Even people like the crowd who's up on the mountaintop. Oh, gosh, it's just 11:10. We're making real progress today. All right? Blessed are those who are what? Happy are those who are what? Ruth, you've got the right. Ruth has the right expression on her face. Ruth is going, the persecuted? The what? Okay, blessed are the what? The persecuted. Why are they persecuted? Because they're living lives that are what? Rightly related to all things. What belongs to them? The kingdom of heaven. Now, people who are, I'm going to do whatever it takes to win at all costs, right? Nobody's going to get a leg up on me. You know, I'm going to do this, that, and the other. It's all of this. And what does that breed in the world? Huh? Jane will tell you, when I was a young Christian, Moody referenced somebody that most of you, he's so old that I'm one of the few people in here that even knew who he was talking about. It's because I'm 2.5 years older than he is. When you get to be 77, you count the halves, okay? You know, when you're young, I'm 3.5. 77 and a half, all right? Working on that. He was talking about Francis Schaeffer. How many of you have never heard of Francis Schaeffer? Raise your hands. See how you missed your audience, Moody? I mean, my goodness, I can't believe. True. Well, Francis Schaeffer probably influenced more people Larry's age and my age than perhaps any other Christian leader of the time. I wanted to fly over to Switzerland one time, and I had a friend who manufactured all of the signs for Gulf Oil and Holiday Inn, and I called Tom, said, can I get a hop on your jet to Switzerland? He says, bad news, just sold it. So my timing was not so good. Here was Schaeffer's philosophy, contrary to Larry this morning. Okay? You want to take the person that you're talking to, and what you want to do is you want to force them to follow through with absolute consistency on what they say they believe. You want to drive them into a corner and drive them to despair. How many of you think that's a great way to, okay? I spent a long time in those early years of my life thinking that's the way to approach people. Guess what I produced? A lot of very people who saw me coming and went, turn the other way, please, whatever you do. Look, there is something that is so important about understanding the logic of truthfulness. And most people are unwilling to live consistently with what they say they believe, because if in fact you point them to the outcome of saying there is no God, oh really? Or your goal is to live to please yourself? Let's talk about where that's going. You think that's true? Let's talk about what Schaeffer, true truth. Okay, so it is important to understand our faith, but do you want to be like me or like Moody in the way you share your faith? I vote for Larry, okay? And so that's persecuted for righteousness' sake. Any of you ever had a decision in your career about doing the right thing? Any of you ever have to make hard decisions about doing the right thing? Was it always easy? Was it always popular? Was it always received well? No. But what did you do? You did the right thing. Righteousness is seeking to do the right thing in every area of your life. Sometimes when you do the right thing, what happens? You get persecuted. Talk to Christians in the third world. Talk to Christians in Iran. Talk to Christians in the Ukraine. Talk to Christians who live through Korea. Talk to Christians in China today. Talk to Christians in Argentina. Anybody, I tell you what, we're just going to load up a plane and we'll all move there for a year or so, okay? Anybody want to go? All right, we'll take a tour and we'll... What we forget is the majority church understands that verse. We don't. The majority church lives in the southern hemisphere of the world. The majority church understands that it is far preferable to have your head cut off for your faithfulness to Christ than to go on living and deny Him. Think about that for a minute. That's what Christians in other parts of the world, that's their daily reality. Or, I'm sorry, we had a friend, Paul Fanastock. Paul, we went down to Brazil to be with him. He was a missionary in Uzbekistan. Okay, he went and working in an eye clinic in Uzbekistan after the wall came down and all. And he was the administrator. and he in this wonderful eye clinic. He said, Bob, they did a great job preparing us for living in a Muslim culture, but they did not prepare us for living in a post-Marxist culture. And so he said, when these people would come in and they would want their eye treatment, guess what they expected back? When they paid for their eye treatment, guess what they expected? A kickback. This is how the world operated, right? And so we fully expect that we are going to get a kickback. Guess what my friend Paul Fahnestock told him? Told him, pound sand. After he did that about five or six times, the State Department came and said, Paul, you are going to be on the next plane out of here, otherwise you're going to be a dead man. Because you did the right thing. And you were hated for doing the right thing because the values of that world system were dead set against it. We could go on and on with those kinds of things. Persecuted because of righteousness. What belongs to those Muslim guys who were beheaded on the beach in Libya? What did they receive when their heads were cut off? The kingdom of heaven. That's the promise. The kingdom of heaven. Now, the kingdom of heaven is the reward for people who are blessed, count it blessed when they're persecuted. I had a guy spit on me one time. That's about as close as I've come to being persecuted in this life. We were in Paris. We were doing a thing at the Faculty of Science, and we'd come out of this cafeteria. And this was during the Vietnam era, and some guy hawked up a big one, and he just spit it right on me and said, Tu es Amerique. You're an American. And that night, we invited him out. We had about 800 or 900 students in this big hall at the Faculty of Science, and at the end of that evening, he was sitting down on the front right row, and he was the first one to break his cups. Do you know what it means in France if they break their cups? It means we want to hear more of what you're saying. He was the first one to break his cup that night and say, we want to hear more of what you guys are talking about in this whole faith thing. That's about as close as I've come to being persecuted and seeing what happens. Any of you in here really been persecuted? Anybody? Anybody want to sign up? Patsy, you want to sign up? You want to be first? No, I'm with Patsy. I want to go back up to Ponte Vedra. All right. Now, blessed are you when people what? When they what? Insult you, persecute you. And how do they talk about you? What do they say about you? Falsely say all kinds of what? Because of whom? Because of me. Because you identify with Jesus. The only group of people I'm careful with that are my Jewish friends. Because I'll tell them, I know why you don't like Jesus. I get it. Because of all that's been done to you in his name. But I don't ever want to back away from identifying with Jesus. Now, if those people in the crowds listening to Jesus, if they identified with him, did they pay a price? You better believe they did. They were outcasts in that whole culture. And so Jesus is telling the crowds, hey, look, when you feel like you're being put out on the margins of things, how should you respond?
Rejoice.
Be glad. Why? Because great is your reward where? In heaven. It may be hell on earth, but what's your reward in heaven going to be? It's going to be great because this is how they treated whom?
Before us, before you.
Okay, the way that the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees treat you is how the religious leadership treated whom? The prophets before you. So what's Jesus telling these just average people? That you're like whom? You're like the prophets. Can you imagine what that... Really? Me? Like the... Yeah, you? You are the what? You are the salt of the earth. Talking to the crowds, not the leadership talking to the crowds. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, what's it good for? Absolutely nothing. What is it that makes a person salty? Larry, what makes somebody salty in your experience? What makes pro golfers salty? Not their language. I mean, they've got good language.
They're very salty.
Yes, they are, right?
No, the salt either brings out flavor,
yeah,
or creates thirst, and that's what you're desiring to do, is to do that in a loving, caring way to make them more attracted to Christ, not to you. But
now, telling the crowd, hey, you are the ones that God's going to use. You're the ones through the way that you're the ones God's going to use to do that. If you don't do that, you're not good for anything, right? Now, you're not only the salt of the earth, who else are you?
Light of the world.
Light of the world. Wow. A city that's set on a hill. If you'd looked off to the left from the Mount of Beatitudes, you see the Golan Heights. There are cities of the Decapolis up there. If you look off to your left, if you look off to the right is the city of Safed. So Jesus is he's just talking about what they saw every day. And he said, a city that's set up on a hill, it can't be what? Can't be hidden. And then he says to you and to me, neither do people light a lamp. You don't light it and put it under a what? Why not?
Because we can't see its light.
Because it's stupid. You do. It'll go out, but you put it on a stand. So, okay, yeah, it came off. So get some super glue, Nick. Okay, yeah. All right, yeah, we'll do it after. What's that?
I'll let you wear mine.
Thank you. Yeah, I get to a heap. Yeah, the guest one up there. Okay, so he's saying, where was I? It gives light to what? Everybody in the house. What is he telling the crowd? You give light to what? Every place you are. All right? Then he says, let your light shine where?
Before men.
Before people. Why? Not just see God in you, but how do they see God in you, according to Jesus? See your what?
Good deeds.
See the deeds that you do. Words and life need to be consistent, right? See your good deeds, and when they see your good deeds, who gets praised? You're telling me that I'm one of the crowd, that I'm one of the hoi polloi, I'm nobody, and that the way I live my life brings praise to my Father in heaven? What's the answer to the question? Would all of you say, I can bring praise to my Father in heaven? Say it with me. I can bring praise to my Father. Even real estate people? Huh? Even real estate people?
Amen.
Amen. Especially real estate people. Yeah. Okay. No matter who we are. Okay. Now, here's where we reconnect with Moses. This is where you start to really understand the Sermon on the Mount. Do not think that I have come to abolish what? The law and the prophets. What book of the Bible do you find the law and the prophets in? The Hebrews, somebody said, who said the New Testament? No, nobody did. Where do you find it? Come on. In the Hebrew Scriptures, right? Do not think I have come to abolish the law. What do our Jewish friends, every Shabbat, what is the focus of worship? It's the Parsha from Torah. Okay, the law, sadly, that's about all they know. When you get with them and you do a study with them and you ask them about the prophets, they go, we don't study that. Come on. And they love getting into it. I've not come to abolish it. What have I come to do? I have come to fulfill them. Now, I tell you the truth. Until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter nor stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from what?
Law.
The law. How many of you are able to write Hebrew? Okay. So would you like to know what the least stroke of a pen is? If you look, it's a jot and a tittle, okay? These are the little overhangs on the Hebrew letters. They are the smallest part of a Hebrew letter. And Jesus is saying, not the least part of one of the letters of the law or the prophets is what? Let me get back to my book. You're really making this hard on me up there, Nick. Yeah, having to hold my microphone. Not one of the least parts of them will disappear until what? Everything is accomplished. So has Jesus, what is he accused? What's he going to be accused of doing, friends? Of what? Who said it? Joy. Breaking the law. Denying the law, not keeping the law because he doesn't keep the what? He doesn't keep the rules the way they want him to keep the rules. All right? So nothing will disappear until everything is accomplished. Who's going to accomplish it? I've told you about the book, My Year of Living Biblically. Here comes the guest mic. Nick, thank you. I hope you can put this back together. Yeah. Otherwise, I'll get docked. There you go. Now we're on. Okay, good. Yeah. Okay. Now, why is it important that Jesus fulfill the law? Because they can't.
Well, also to death.
They can't, but we can, right? No, they can't keep the law. Why is it important that Jesus did? So he could be what, John?
Perfect sacrifice.
Perfect sacrifice. If he had not fulfilled the law, could he have become the sacrifice for our sin? No. He fulfilled the law perfectly for you and me so that he could offer himself for those of us who, anybody here want to try keeping the law perfectly? We can't. Okay? So that we might receive grace. Now, anyone who breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will go to hell. Well, your book reads differently than mine.
Yes, it's called the least.
It's called the what? Least where?
In the kingdom of heaven.
Oh, do you mean they're going to be in heaven? Is that what Jesus is saying?
Well, yeah.
Yes, I think so. I think that's exactly what he's saying. Yeah. Okay. Be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Page 437, Debbie. Yeah. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called what? Great. Keeping the law. For I tell you that unless... Now, again, here's the crowd. Who's the crowd? Who's there? All these people... Teachers of the law hanging around the edges and talking to the crowd, unless your righteousness is better than these religious dudes standing out on the edge, okay, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. How'd that make you feel?
Well, they claim to keep it perfect.
Oh, it's this pure in heart stuff you're back to again. Is that what you're bringing us back to? Okay, now, wait a minute, but how am I going to know if I'm keeping the law the way I'm supposed to? Who do you think's going to tell me? You think that might be part of the Sermon on the Mount? That's what Jesus is going to start teaching now. You have heard that it was said long ago, do not murder. It's always, I told you when I was a kid in high school, one of my buddies, his dad drove around with an old electric chair on top of his car. You know why he did? He was in the electric chair. They threw the... Lauren? Oh, I'm 2 minutes over, aren't I? And you guys are all waiting out there. Of course you are. Okay, I'll wrap up and turn it over to you in just a minute. Okay, so he carried an electric chair around on the top of his car because he was strapped in it. They hit the switch and nothing happened. And so he got to walk away free. He carried that chair around on top of his car, reminded him everywhere he went of what had happened to him. So now, okay, have any of you in here murdered anybody? It's always a little dangerous to ask that question. Okay.
Bob, we had that joke in the morning after coming off the Beltway.
Okay, that was the joke every morning. Did you murder anybody on the Beltway?
It's like saying fool if they ran, cut you off.
Okay, all right, Jerry's take. So here's where we're going starting next Sunday. Okay, has anybody ever called the driver in front of you a fool? Besides me, all right? So Jesus is now going to take these. How many of you have never murdered anybody? Come on, hands up. You've never murdered anybody so far as you know, all right? All of a sudden now, we're going to be talking about the law and what it really means. So that's starting next Sunday. All right? Okay. Good start to the Beatitudes.
Great.
Thank you. God bless. Have a great week. We'll see you next Sunday.